people across the country are continuing to feel the squeeze from high housing costs. And now a number of Democratic presidential contenders are putting forward plans to address the issue. Andra Gent joins us now for a look at the issue of housing affordability. She is an associate professor of real estate and urban land economics with the UW-Madison School of Business. Andra, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, how big of a problem do you see housing affordability being across the United States right now?
I think everybody agrees that this is a huge problem. It's been growing in importance for a number of years, and I think that we're now sort of recognizing that we have to tackle it in a more direct fashion. So I think it is a huge problem, and I'm actually really happy to hear a number of presidential candidates talking about the issue.
Before we get into their approaches to tackling this plan, I think a lot of times when people think high housing costs, they think of particular big cities, San Francisco, parts of New York City, Seattle, where there are just rapidly escalating housing costs. But we've also talked on this show about rural Wisconsin facing housing affordability problems. This is across a lot of different communities, right?
Yeah, it is very widespread. It's you know, obviously, it's especially prevalent in some of these very supply-constrained cities. You know, the constraints in Wisconsin are not necessarily that we can't build more housing. It's more that the cost of building housing has gone up, and we don't see as much as you can't build rental housing for the same price as you used to be able to. And of course, the new tariffs are only going to make this worse, as I'm sure you're imagining. I mean, the other thing that's sort of changed is the rise in inequality, and this has been going on for, you know, 30 or 40 years, but particularly in the central business district, sort of as you go out from downtown areas in cities like certainly Madison and Milwaukee, you're bidding, everybody's bidding for the same space, right? And whether you earn $20,000 a year or $200,000 a year, people are bidding on essentially the same thing. So if you can't build more of it, that a rise in inequality means that the bottom half of the income distribution is more constrained. And so I just want to be clear that when we talk about the housing affordability problem, we're primarily talking about a rental income problem. It's not really we don't have – I don't think people are spending more on owner-occupied housing. It's primarily rental and primarily in the bottom half of the income distribution of renters.
And I've seen a case made that there's a trickle-over effect, I guess. Those people who are paying more for rent are therefore not able to save up that down payment if and when they do want to buy a house.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned renting, and a lot of the Democratic platforms on housing are addressing renting. Is it fair to say that most federal policy over the years is focused on the homeowner, not the renter?
Absolutely. We have had decades of policies focused on housing affordability for owner-occupiers. And we have, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars of federal tax credits going to homeowners. So the mortgage interest deduction, not having to pay capital gains on your primary residence, not having the imputed rent of your own home tax. These are all benefits that have accrued to homeowners, and homeowners tend to come from the, you know, the top two thirds of the income distribution. And yet we've had much less attention paid to rental housing. Now we have had some federal programs to support building rental programs, but it's clear that those aren't deep enough. And certainly the voucher program, which is the biggest federal program, as some of your listeners may know, that doesn't reach nearly as many people as are eligible. And so there really just isn't enough supply. So what I see with some of these, particularly Senator Booker's program, is basically it's an expansion of the voucher program. It turns a voucher program, which was used to be something you might or might not be able to get, into an entitlement. That's how I see parts of these plans, similarly with Senator Harris's plan.
Talking to Andra Gent right now, associate professor of real estate and urban land economics at UW-Madison School of Business, looking at rental problems in the United States, rent costs going up in many communities, lack of availability in a lot of places too, and Democratic presidential candidates starting to release platforms on how they want to tackle that. You mentioned that idea of the renters tax credits, part of Senator Booker's plan and others. One concern people raise is, okay, if you have these credits for people, they can afford to pay a little more for housing, well then maybe landlords are just going to bump up their prices that much. There's not really a savings for people. How does this tend to play out in practice?
Yeah, so that's a very legitimate concern. And it's an especially legitimate concern in California, where if you're not building new supply, the net effect is it all gets reflected in higher rents. Now, a couple thoughts on this. So it really depends on the supply elasticity. I think Wisconsin's a little bit better on that front. Even if that's true, I think these expansion, what I see these as a lot of expansion of a voucher program into an entitlement program, some of it, I think, is an implicit income redistribution program. So we often have some resistance to income redistribution programs, but I think this is, even if it raises rents overall, if you're redistributing income to the lowest third of the income distribution, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
What are some other policies that you see being proposed by candidates that that tackle different angles on the rental problem?
Yeah, so I think that both Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker's plans have elements of tackling the supply issue of how do we get more supply. And I'm really happy to hear that they're talking about local zoning restrictions and building codes. And these are some of the biggest, if you talk to any developer, why can't you build affordable housing? And they'll cite a couple of things, is that it just takes so long to get it through the paperwork. And that's something that cities create. Cities create barriers to developing housing, and they have the ability to reduce these barriers. Now, I don't know how successful. The devil is in sort of in the details. And so we need to see what the details are of how they're going to tackle these zoning restrictions. But that would be the hope, that we see them actually provide some incentive to cities or I'm not sure how much sway the federal government has over cities. But I like that we're talking about it. We're acknowledging that cities are creating a lot of their own problems in terms of resisting affordable housing. And oftentimes it's a little bit of a not in my backyard thing, where it's like, okay, well, maybe Middleton shouldn't do it. Maybe we need more affordable housing, but maybe it's not Middleton. Maybe it should be Sun Prairie. It's somewhere else. It's always somebody else's problem.
Right. And this is something that seems to be replicated in community after community, wealthier or at least middle class and up residents who may have a bit more political sway might be resistant to the idea of changing the zoning that allows more affordable housing, maybe rental units in their neighborhoods. This is something we see around the country.
Yeah, and I see it even, we see it, definitely see it around the country, but I see it even in often certain buildings that like to be owner-occupied, they get very resistant to the idea that there might be renters in the building, too. So I think everybody has some resistance to it. But the municipalities do have the power of saying, we're not going to enforce minimum lot sizes. We're going to allow heights. We're going to allow you to build to a certain height. We're not going to, some of the other things are allow what sort of bedrooms. One of the things that would really help is, right now, most developers, if they're building multifamily, they're going to build one bedroom, one bath. And what we really need to start seeing is a two bedroom to one bath. In that affordable segment, we really need kind of lower construction costs. And so the question is sort of how do you incentivize that? And some of it is through the unit mix. There's a number of things that cities can do, but the zoning restrictions are a really good place to start. Just allow. So that's sort of a market solution where you just allow developers to build highest and best use. In many cases, that's going to be multifamily.
We're picking up our conversation about an affordable housing, what some people are calling crisis in the United States, and some proposals we're seeing from 2020 presidential candidates to deal with the issue, especially when it comes to rentals. Andra Gent is with us from the Real Estate and Urban Land Economics Program at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are things like in your part of the state when it comes to affordable housing, a place you can afford to rent. Do you think elected officials at the local, state, or federal levels are paying enough attention? Do you have a question for our guest? And is this an issue that affects the work you do? If you're in local government or if you're a developer, what do you see as a reason that there might not be affordable housing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andra, another part of U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren's plan when it comes to housing has to do with taking on discrimination, racial discrimination in particular in housing. What kind of things are we seeing out there in 2019?
Yeah, so, I mean, this has been something we've been working on for a very long time, and we have a number of policies in place in the mortgage market to prevent it. And overall, in the mortgage market, I think we're doing a pretty good job. That's my sense. It may still exist on some level, but it's small. And so we've really, I think that's a success of federal policy on mortgage market discrimination overall. And again, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying it's small and is not super frequent. On the rental side, you know, audit studies, so this is often when you either use a name that is more associated with African-American households, or you send an actor in that's African-American or white, and you basically look at how the landlords respond, and there's still a lot of discrimination in the rental market. So I liked, I don't know exactly, again, the details, we need to see some details on this. One of the elements of Elizabeth Warren's policy I like is down payment assistance for minority households. I like that because what we know is that underrepresented minority households tend to have less wealth for the same income. So you can go to college, you can get a good job, you work hard, and yet we're still not seeing these underrepresented minorities build a lot of wealth. And a lot of that is that it's an intergenerational thing. My concern, though, and this is why I'm sort of hesitant to endorse it without seeing a bit more on the details front, is that we need to be very careful that homeownership is the right choice for some households. So one of the things, you know, the viewers that are my age or older will remember the financial crisis, and affordable housing policy was not to blame for it. I want to make that 100% clear. One of the things that we did see was a narrative where regulators didn't maybe clamp down on what they saw in the mortgage market. And part of it was, well, these products are helping low-income and minority households become homeowners. And unfortunately, a lot of people did become homeowners and subsequently lost their homes within, you know, a few years. And that was not a positive experience. So I just want to be very careful about what is this going to look like? Because we know people default on their mortgages when they don't have a stake in it. And so if this is so I need to see the details on this, but I appreciate her considering the matter.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I work for a major, and I'm talking a very major window company. And so we deliver all Wisconsin, UP, Illinois, and I don't see any affordable housing going up. Every house that we deliver to, and we deliver to new builds, is always at least $1 million. Well, actually, I shouldn't say $1 million. At least $300,000 and up. So, I mean, I can't afford a $300,000 house. My house is $150,000. And like I said, my windows are extremely expensive. So, I mean, and we see farm fields all the time are becoming subdivisions, and like I said, the houses are never underneath $300,000. So how can anybody afford that?
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And I've seen an argument back and forth over the years, Andra, on this. One along Nick's side, hey, we're building expensive houses. We're not building affordable stuff. Other people say, well, hold on, there's a trickle-down effect. Wealthier people will buy these more expensive places that takes the demand and pressure off of the houses that they might have bought otherwise. What do you see when it comes to what kind of housing we're building?
Yeah, so I think there is some element, we call it filtering, where there is always, you know, when you build new expensive homes, I'm glad you brought that up, then it does, the older housing stock will filter down a little bit. I mean, overall, new supply is always going to bring down housing prices. That's just sort of a fact. So we always like new supply. There's often one of the things that people often get confused about is they see neighborhoods where a bunch of new expensive housing goes up, and they say this is the cause of why housing is getting expensive in this neighborhood. And usually the causality is the reverse. The developer picks a neighborhood because land values are rising, and then they put the sort of housing because they see who's moving into the neighborhood. So people often get that a little bit mixed up in the causality. You know, then the question, okay, so if we did want to change the mix of units, then I think that you need to provide some incentives. And this is usually at the local level. You know, I don't know how much the federal government can really do, but at least historically, they have not gone into these sort of details where you say, you know, I only want in this, we're going to zone as residential two is going to be a minimum of this or maximum square footage of this sort of unit, and you get into really the details of the unit mix, or you know, lot size that often, you know, it's a big lot usually if you're going to put a $300,000 house on it. But I think you really need to talk to the developers and sort of say, hey, what are your barriers? Why is it not financially feasible for you to build affordable housing? And then you need to, once you've heard from that, you need to sort of say, okay, what incentives can we provide if it's important to us? What sort of incentives can we provide to make them build smaller homes or lower cost construction materials? You know, one thing I think that's really important to think about is zoning more mobile home parks. That's actually a super affordable way of housing people, and yet many cities are very resistant to zoning more mobile home parks. But that's a very affordable way of housing people.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Why are cities resistant to that idea of mobile home parks?
You know, I think they have or sometimes they're manufactured homes, you know, modular homes, sometimes they go by the name of. I think that, you know, it's a very good question. I think they have a stigma associated with them. I know there's been something like 20 zoned in the last like 30 years or something across the entire country. So I think there's a stigma and people don't want that. I think it's a concentration of low income housing. But I think that also, I mean, things have changed. The type of housing you can get in a trailer park now, the quality is pretty good. I hesitate to use the word trailer park because that's what's been stigmatized. But you can build fairly high quality housing at a very affordable price. And so I would like to see cities consider zoning a whole lot more of these. That would be another thing I think that they may want to consider.
Andrea, in our last minute or so, do you see policymakers from the local to the federal level starting to maybe wake up and switch gears some when it comes to this issue of high rental costs?
Yeah, I think they are. And I think it's good we're talking about this on the federal stage. You know, I think it's really important, and I know in a lot of Wisconsinites are very engaged with their local policymakers because I think these are primarily local levels. And the national political debates often get a lot of the media attention, but I think what can tackle these problems most effectively is often local policies. But I think across the nation we're getting more and more attention on this issue because it is a nationwide issue, even if a lot of the solutions might come from the local level.
Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That's Andrea Gent, Associate Professor of Real Estate at Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison's School of Business. She was with us today to look at the affordable housing problems across the United States when it comes to affordable rent in particular, and now some solutions being offered by 2020 presidential contenders.